Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with James Jordan, who is the brand new ballet master at Sarasota Ballet in Sarasota, Florida. As you will hear at the very beginning of this interview, James is the first ballet master I have interviewed, and I didn't really know what a ballet master was, and so James kindly explained it to me. James's story is interesting because he didn't know he wanted to be a ballet dancer. And he learned it, created it, discovered it, embraced it around the age of 17, which is very late to be starting a career as a ballet dancer. And so listening to the way James's life evolved is really inspiring. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources, oh,
person you really are, not the person you think you should be, or that you think you ought to be, or the person you'd like to be, or the person you were told to be, or the person other people want you to be, but the person you really are. As a therapist, it is clear to me that most of us are demonstrating a portion of who we are, a version of who we are, but in no way the totality of who we are. So many of us were discouraged from being our whole, real self and encouraged to pretend, to hide, to dissemble, to lose, sacrifice aspects of ourselves, qualities about ourselves, abilities, interests, curiosities, behaviors, all kinds of things which for one reason or another did not fit in the idea that our families had of what a child of theirs should be, or maybe you didn't fit the image that most of the kids in school fit, Or maybe you demonstrated something a teacher didn't like or was uncomfortable with. Or maybe your religion or your culture frowned on something that was natural to you, organic to you, essential to you. Well, we can't really get through our childhood comfortably unless we minimize the number of ways in which we are not what others want us to be. So kids learn very quickly, to the extent that it is possible for them, to hide, to pretend, to dissemble, to say, that is not me, I am this, like you, or what you want, or what will work. And ironically, we then forget that we did that, and we forget that we have these qualities, and so we come into adulthood with a sort of limited version of who we are. That works in our childhood. That is essential. That is not crazy or neurotic. But it is problematic as we get older. It's difficult to suppress parts of ourselves, and it takes energy that we could otherwise use. And also, although we have forgotten these things, they linger. We know that there's something wrong. Many people think of themselves as a fraud, or that thing, you know, if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me, or the Woody Allen line, you know, I wouldn't want to be a member of a club that would have me. All of that self-deprecating, self-loathing kind of stuff comes from the recognition that there is something about me that I am in denial for. Well, that is not the best way to live. At least that's what I think. And so the Lynn Show is about making the point that this does happen. It happens to most of us in one way or another, and to some of us dramatically. And I believe that it is possible to recover the things you have had to sacrifice to be more and more and more who you are, and that that occurrence, that ability, makes for a sweeter, easier life. It is not easy to recover. I don't mean to give that impression. But it can be done. Of course, that is what psychotherapy is about. If you're curious about that, get more information about that from my website, which is thelynshow.com. thelynneshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. That's thelynshow.com. And you can listen to all of the shows, including the one I'm doing right now, and all of the interviews, including the one I'm about to play. And all of my interviews are of people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do that because when you hear these people speak, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. It's my hope that this is inspiring to you to ask yourself whether this is also true for you, this passion, commitment, intensity about your life. And today's interview with James Jordan is a very interesting example of this. James is the brand new ballet master at the Sarasota Ballet in Sarasota, Florida. And James understood quite young that he had an interest in performance, he had an interest in movement, and as he says, in discipline. But it wasn't until he was 17, and through a series of really accidental events, occurrences, that he discovered that the passion in his life was ballet. And the story of how he pursues this, his dedication, his passion, his commitment to this, is so appealing, so interesting. The interview will begin
with James explaining to me exactly what a ballet master does, and then
talking about the very next production of the Sarasota Ballet Company, and then we will get into talking about James, how he discovered ballet, how he found himself where he is. This was a very long interview, which I really didn't want to cut, because aside from the fascinating, interesting aspect of the story,
James is funny and charming.
So this is just part one, and hopefully you will listen for part two next week. But here now is James Jordan.
I'm
interviewing James Jordan because he is the new ballet master at the Sarasota Ballet and because I've never interviewed a ballet master.
Oh, wow.
So first, can you just tell me what the ballet master does?
I'm really designed to help Margaret Barbieri, the assistant director, with scheduling. I share rehearsals. I'm learning ballets. I'm taking care of extracurricular projects when the company performs around town. It's an ever-evolving job description that never stops growing.
Tell everybody what's coming up, whatever it is you want to say about the season.
Well, the connection with Maggie and Ian is so phenomenal. They have that connection with Sir Frederick Ashton's work. And I have the connection with Anthony Tudor's work. They were both highly revered British choreographers who were contemporaries of each other. It's a complex story, but Tudor landed at American Ballet Theatre, and Frederick Ashton remained at the Royal Ballet as they created works in the 40s and all the way through the 70s. And it's so interesting now that Sarasota Ballet is essentially an American home of Ashton and Tudor being together under one roof, and it just makes such lovely sense. Mm-hmm. And that Maggie and Ian have that respect for historic work, and they respect the audience here in Sarasota. They're passionate about bringing these great ballets that they know to Sarasota because they know they're going to love them. You know, he's not scheduling what's going to sell an extra 100 tickets for entertainment. He's really bringing great art to Sarasota, and I've just so lucky to have landed in such an artistically vibrant place that's so respectful, and the dancers are so wonderful and so dedicated to Maggie and Ian and their vision, and they're so cooperative, and they work so hard every day, and they seem to like my work. And right now we're going with a second round of the Secret Garden that was created this summer. And on our November program, Will Tuckett, who created the Secret Garden, he has worked here in previous seasons. He's a Royal Ballet dancer who has retired. And he, last season, created Lux Aeterna, which is a wonderful choral piece that is returning, and he came back in September and revived that on the company, and I was with him, and we've continued to rehearse that and get, it's reviving on dancers who it was created on, but also we're expanding to a second cast of people who have just gotten their first exposure to it in September, so we're continuing to work on that. It's just a magical, really lovely work.
When will it be?
The weekend of November 21st and 22nd at the Opera House, and it will be a very special weekend. On that program are two other ballets. We've just learned from Sandra Jennings, the representative of the Balanchine Trust, his ballet Rubies from the full-length Jewels that he created. And that's a wonderful Stravinsky score. And both Rubies and Lux Aeterna will be performed with live music.
Wow.
Very thrilling. So we'll have the choir directed by Joe Calkins. And I'm happy to say Francisco Reno, who was a wonderful, wonderfully talented pianist who was in Kansas City with the ballet there for 18 years, he's been with Edward Villella in Miami City Ballet for a number of years, and has played Rubies hundreds of times and just tears it apart. Fabulous. And Francisco is coming in to play Rubies for us. So it's going to be a killer program. Christopher Bruce is also staging his work, Sergeant Early Dreams, and that's a wonderful piece that will close the program. It's more episodic, and what a contrast to the two other works. It's just a phenomenal evening. I mean, Ian, what a genius he is.
Okay, so this is all November 21st and 22nd.
Yes, those three works.
Right. Okay, so are you a dancer?
I was a dancer.
I only ask one question. Do you remember the very first moment in your life when dancing, movement, performance, called you, seemed attractive?
I think there's not one lightning bolt moment. I grew up in a very small town in Stanton, Virginia. My father was a Presbyterian minister. There was always music around, and I remember holding on to a tiny little chair that my grandfather made and exercising along with Jack LaLanne on TV. So I had that instinct for discipline and movement and learning and observing.
When you were working out with Jack LaLanne, how old were you?
Oh, I was 5. And I had a little sort of do the twist moment in front of the whole church at a dinner or something in front of everyone when I was maybe 3 or 4.
So I was really theatrical, right.
And not shy.
The twist moment, can you remember that?
I do, actually. Mm-hmm. It was a green fabric curtain up on a little stage in this social hall, and mm-hmm. I just went with the moment there, and everyone was captivated. I know that it was not planned.
It wasn't planned?
No. I think some music appeared, and I
And
responded.
So did you.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So this starts very early for you, this impulse to be watched while you are doing something, movement. Didn't you take lessons?
Well, I didn't know of any dance option in this very small town, and I really segued quickly into music and plays. I appeared in community productions as well as high school and junior high productions.
And how did your family feel about it?
They were supportive in a certain way.
But they probably didn't think it was any lasting thing in your life.
Right. It was just like going off to play basketball next door or something.
Right, right, exactly.
Went off to do that.
Okay, so you must have found dance at some point.
I did, but it really wasn't until quite later in high school that I heard through a cheerleader at school that there was a Mormon woman in the next town who gave classes on a concrete tile floor in the church basement, and it was a 1-2-hour class a week of ballet, tap, and jazz. 2/3 of that was a ballet class.
Okay, so you go to take this, and do you get captured?
What happened, and that was really instigated by the fact that I was starting to look at college options. I was deciding to major in drama. And I was looking at the various programs around. I needed to stay in state for financial reasons. And I wasn't really that academically inclined. So I was heading towards Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond because I thought if I didn't like school, they at least had dinner theaters and other things that I could do there.
Right, so you're still thinking about being an actor, a performer.
Right. And from 1 year of those lessons in the church basement, I got a job, a summer job, as a dancer at Unto These Hills on the Cherokee Indian Reservation in Cherokee, North Carolina. It was one of those historic outdoor dramas on these giant amphitheaters outside, a big tourist draw, mm-hmm. that tells the story of the Cherokee Indian, how they got there.
Okay, how did you get this job?
I heard that there were auditions for 15 different outdoor dramas.
Right.
And I drove down to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, just to see if someone would grab me up.
So let me see if I get this right. You have 6 months of 2 hours a week dance training, and you decide to go and audition as a dancer.
And I got the job.
And you got the job, right.
Well, I was a tall male.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it still continues today that any man walks through the door and you're...
They say, oh, good.
Right. There's a scholarship. You know, it still
Oh,
happens.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't realize that. But, okay, right. So now, do your parents recognize that this is not just like basketball?
Yeah, they do, because they see that I'm going off to college with a theatrical direction.
Yeah, right.
And they're not giving me speeches about earning a living or any of that. They're just allowing me to do what
Good
I
for
feel
them.
I need to do. Yes. So they weren't particularly encouraging, but the fact that they weren't discouraging was very helpful.
Okay, so you get this job as a dancer.
Right. So I then, at that point, all summer I had a ballet class every day. and learned and worked on other musicals and dance concerts, you know, because it's this whole group of theatrical people gathered for a summer, so they're working on other things in addition to just sort of cranking out this big show every night.
Yeah, know? And you're also now in a community that says this is a legitimate thing to do.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, let's work on this, let's do this, let's get better together.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, that's great.
It's like, wow.
Okay,
I think I got $75 a week and room and board.
That wasn't bad.
Yeah.
No, it was great.
I got my money's worth out of those ballet lessons in the church basement.
Yes, you did.
So then I was set to go to Virginia Commonwealth University that next fall. Mm-hmm. And I learned that the Richmond Ballet was two blocks down from my dorm room. So I walk through the door and get a scholarship. And so I'm there every minute I can possibly be. In addition to my drama training, I'm taking ballet lessons every night I can be there.
Okay, wait a second. What I missed, what I haven't heard, but which is clearly implied in what you're saying, is that at some point, ballet stood up and said, this is it. Did I miss that?
Well, I didn't share the fact that there were people in Cherokee who said, you've got what it takes, but you've got to jump on that train now.
Yeah, it's late.
Yeah. Oh, it's very late. I'm at 17, 18.
So that Cherokee thing was so profoundly important to you. So when they said, you have what it takes, but you have to work at it.
I said, yeah, baby. Let's
yeah?
go.
Okay. All right. So it sounded like a good thing to you.
Right.
Okay. So now you're in college, and you're in the Richmond Ballet Company?
It's a school at that point. It was just prior to it becoming even a professional company, which it is now.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a student company, and there were guest teachers who had been dancers with all of the Ballet Russes. And there were some who were based there and guest teachers coming and going. And I was instantly put in productions, and I was partnering women on point. And I had these little wunderkind kids who were dancing at School of American Ballet in the summers. And they were dancing circles around me and giggling and all of that because I was so bad
But you were dancing with them.
Right.
Anyway.
Right. I mean, I was 6 foot tall and, you know, behind.
right.
To say the least.
Right. So how did you feel about it?
Well, I'm not sure how my ego took that.
Yeah.
But I just had my eye on the prize and just pushed on through and was able to laugh at myself. And I received enough encouragement along the way. And I just kept going.
What I hear then is this kind of single-mindedness, you know, this ability to focus, as you say, on the prize and to endure the short-term distress, embarrassment, whatever it was. Were you sure that you were going to get there, or was it just, I'm going to give it my best shot because I love this?
It just seemed, everything just kept unfolding in front
yes,
of me.
Right.
So I just sort of followed the flow.
Yeah, right. So you're still in school studying drama.
Right. And that was quickly losing focus for me. And I felt like we were in circles holding hands and imagining lampshades and just doing weird stuff that didn't feel like it was really getting me where I wanted to go.
It's like the song from Chorus Line. Nothing, do you know?
Yes.
Right?
It just wasn't rocking my world.
Right.
So it was clear that I was not going to be there another year. And meanwhile, there were dancers coming and going from the Richmond Ballet who had studied there previously but had gone on to study at North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem.
Mm.
So I talked to them when they would come home at Christmas and at spring break, and I got interested in going there too because I knew that I needed more than the classes I was getting at Richmond. I really needed an all-day, all-night program to catch up. So
Wait, I just want to stop you. Are you thinking, I want a career with this? I mean, because you're giving it your life. So are you thinking, or you're not thinking about that? It's just more of, well, this is the next thing. This comes up. I'll just do that. But there's no, this is what I want to do. This is what I have to do. It's just the, do you know what I'm asking you?
It seemed so clear at the time. I didn't question.
No, or look ahead.
Right. One couldn't be practical at that time.
No.
I would have turned and run.
That's what I mean. So what's so wonderful about this is your willingness to, as they say in the cliche, be in the moment. In this moment, this feels good, and this comes up, and that looks interesting, so I'll do that without any looking past that.
And I didn't have financial security at the time.
That was my other question, right.
I mean, in that period in Richmond, I guess it was the summer when the drama school was over, but I continued studying. I was frying chicken that summer to sort of pay the rent. I had two roommates, and I was sharing an apartment. So I was doing what I needed to do to survive.
Exactly, and to do this thing, which becomes more and more about ballet, right?
Right.
Right. So did you go to North Carolina?
I auditioned there and also for SUNY Purchase in New York, which had a more contemporary direction. Somehow I thought one of those two would take me. And I auditioned for both and was accepted at both and chose Winston-Salem. And so I was there by that next fall.
And frying chicken?
I had enough scholarships come my way, and I took out student loan things to survive and found a Richmond person, was a roommate there to make that possible, and off I went.
Yeah, I'm just so fascinated with the ability to be so focused in the moment with no particular idea of where this was going, only that this feels right now. That's what you're saying?
Right.
Yeah, it's great.
Right.
And quite unusual, I think. Maybe you don't know that.
Maybe.
Because it's just who you are, right?
I guess.
Okay, yeah. So now you're in Winston-Salem.
Winston-Salem.
And what happens?
Well, I'm working my tail off. I'm not good enough to be used much in the ballet programs there, but the modern contemporary department scoops me up, and I'm rehearsing with them at night and studying ballet all day.
Wow.
But within their program, which was so fabulous, they had Graham dancers teaching the contemporary classes and these excruciating floor bars and things that it was really... it was like boot camp for me. And
you don't look particularly strong. Were you? Are you?
I was I was particularly sort of scrawny and weak. And, I didn't have strength for partnering much.
Mm-hmm.
And I had shin splints, and I had bruised big toenails because I would jump and land on my big toe heel. And
so it doesn't matter what happens, you just keep going.
Right. And I'm receiving encouragement along the way, but I also am getting snickers from teachers who, they would grab my leg and they would comment on how heavy it was. And they would giggle at my turnout. And I guess that kind of got better, but it was clear through my whole career that I was a dancer who started a little late.
Yes, and that to some extent, there's no way to catch that up.
Correct.
Right.
And I was tall and princely and had a feeling for classical movement.
Mm-hmm.
So I became a classical partner, but not a classical dancer.
Ah, well,
I tried and I pushed, and but I felt like as a dancer I excelled in more contemporary directions.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a feeling for that, and I just kind of had guts to dive down, and I had good knees that I could be on the floor and enjoyed that transition from up to down.
Wow.
And I think that has served me as a ballet master, just helping really intense ballet people to make that transition to contemporary movement.
Okay, well, look the way, because I want to get there. Absolutely.
Right,
we'll go there. Okay. I'm just absolutely fascinated by the what I see as a contradictory stuff here. I mean, you know, it's so hard, and although you keep saying I got encouragement, so much of what you experienced had to be discouraging. I mean, another person, I think, might have been discouraged by all of those things. I don't know how much encouragement you got, but if you weigh them, so did you get a lot of encouragement that helped you balance this discouragement, or you just didn't care about the discouragement? I don't care, I'm doing this. You know what I'm asking you?
I think I got a decent amount.
Enough.
I clearly got enough to kept going.
Yeah, you did.
But I found wonderful teachers there, and they had Ballet Russe background, and there were New York City Ballet dancers there, Joyce Ann Sedemus and Mimi Paul, and that was a new direction of speed and intensity and an approach to turnout. And so suddenly that New York City Ballet focus was of interest to me, and they had a lovely arts library at the school there. So that's when I first started to learn about dance history and who my teachers were and all of that. We had dance history courses and all of that. So
So you're expanding now your interests and what you know about dance? Is that
right,
what you mean?
Because I knew so little.
Yeah.
I remember back to Richmond, I saw my first performance was seeing the Hartford Ballet. And that was a really small company, maybe 12 ballet dancers, but they danced Balanchine's Allegro Brilliant. And, that really rocked my world. And so, amazingly, I got to dance that ballet. All those years later, I got to dance the lead in Allegro Brilliant.
Oh, my God.
How amazing.
How amazing.
Yeah.
When in Richmond, that's when you were in college. When you
yes.
saw that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It was just a tour of Hartford Ballet coming through.
Yeah. So. Okay, so now, how long were you in Winston-Salem?
I guess 2 full years and a summer. And
how old are you then?
20.
20.
20, pushing 21. And suddenly there's one day in class, it was a December, we were working on the Nutcracker there, and there was an older gentleman watching class. And no one knew who that was. And that man would change my life. And it turned out to be Todd Bolander, who was one of Balanchine's early male dancers. He created Phlegmatic on him from Forties and Agon. And he was a central figure in Jerome Robbins' early works, and he really had the goods.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been asked to take the Kansas City Ballet and make it a professional company. So he was scouting the country.
Mm-hmm.
He obviously was a protege of George Balanchine, so he had gone to the School of American Ballet and had gotten some of their kids. And part of it was the challenge of, Todd was 68 at the time.
Mm.
And between the fact that Todd was considered old and that no one knew of Kansas City or wanted to go there, he wanted to train people. So he wanted young people and not tried and true professionals.
No, he wanted somebody he could
mold.
Exactly right.
So then he auditioned out in Los Angeles. There were some city ballet dancers there with schools. And he assembled 16 of us. So there were 4 of us at school who were offered contracts to Kansas City Ballet.
So wait, I'm just curious. So after the class, he comes over and says, I'd like to talk to you, or you get called into an office, or he's waves at you, or what?
We learned later, maybe the next day, that was Todd Bolander, and he was you know.
Did you know who he was?
At dancers. I didn't, but I went to the library and read about
right,
him.
Right, right.
Like, who's that?
Right. So you heard from somebody else that you'd been offered this contract.
Yes, the four of us that Todd was interested in, we were called into the dean's office, and there was a conference call, and Todd was on the phone. And we were told before the call that he was interested in us coming to Kansas City. And, I'm sure Todd had to finish his rounds and figure out who he needed.
Right.
And it was quite the buzz at school when the word got out that the four of us were offered jobs, because we weren't necessarily the stars of the class.
No, because that's not what he wanted.
Right. But also, and I could see that later, he was really preparing, because the board in Kansas City didn't know how far the future was. They asked Todd to present a one-night gala in May of 1981, and that would potentially kickstart the company, but
right.
No one really knew if the city would get behind the board and make this happen or not. So Todd was really casting the ballets that he planned for that gala evening.
Right.
And one of his more famous works he wanted to close that program with was the ballet Souvenirs. And it was a very theatrical comedy that took place in a hotel in the 1900s, and with a Samuel Barber score. And he had created that on New York City Ballet in 1955. And it was one of his signature works. And it was really wonderful ballet with all these characters from the 20s. There was a vamp and a gigolo and tea couple. And the finale was on the beach. Everyone was in the old-fashioned wool bathing suits with the gorilla and the beach ball and the whole deal. So he was casting, so the four of us at North Carolina, I was the dream lover who would wear the pink satin suit, and he got the gigolo and the vamp and the man about town. The four of us were those four lead characters and Souvenirs.
Yeah, right. So he was, it's what you said, he was casting for this night.
But he also thought we had potential.
So I guess you guys did the gala.
Yeah, so the four of us, one of us had a car, and then we rented this tiny little U-Haul truck, and we drove out to Kansas City in February. We finished our little winter concert and then hit the road. And I remember the toilets in one of the gas stations on the way were frozen solid.
Yes, I'm imagining you're driving in February to Kansas City. Oy.
So none of us had been there, and none of us had ever considered, much less wanted, to be there. You know, so we just went there, and we stayed with board members for a couple of nights while we found apartments. And they had secured an old school and created one big studio and a couple of small ones upstairs, because Todd adopted Balanchine's philosophy of incorporating a school with the company. So right away he wanted live music with the orchestra, and he wanted a school.
So I'm just imagining that the four of you are scratching your heads and saying, you know, what have we gotten into here?
Absolutely. I mean, talk about the grand adventure.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, you're young.
Right.
And this is what's next, right? This is what's come up, so this is what you're doing.
And my teachers knew Todd, the ones from North Carolina, and they sat us down and said, we believe in Todd. Mm-hmm. He's a fabulous choreographer, really interesting dancer. He's got the goods. You guys should go.
Right.
So we did.
Yeah. Okay, so you went in February. Oh, and the gala was in May.
Right.
So you were committed, really, for what, I don't know, March, April, May, June, July, like 3 months.
Right.
Right?
And we could have gone back to school
after
the fall.
That.
We kind of put all of our scholarships on hold and did a little paperwork at the office at the school, just so we didn't have a backup.
That's right.
And so we... So the boot camp continued in Kansas City, because that was very intense, really old school Balanchine training from Todd.
Well, and his career depends on this now.
Right. He's been directing and choreographing in Europe, in Turkey, in Japan, in Germany, and bringing the American musical to Europe. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a really interesting guy. I mean, and brave as well. I mean, he had interpreters and living in Istanbul, and, you know, he had quite a life. But things, I think he had done that in the 60s and 70s, and I think he was ready to come back to America. I think things, he had gone through a good cycle, and he was ready to come back, and the Kansas City Board had gone to Lincoln Kirstein at New York City Ballet for a recommendation, and Lincoln recommended Todd, and so it worked out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so 3 months of extremely difficult work, I'm imagining.
Yes.
Right? And
which included a black tie fundraiser. So we also we learned waltzing, because our first appearance as a company would be in waltzing in gowns and tails, and it was, you know, that was our first introduction to the city. So that was sort of our finishing school of of, you know, elegance and waltzing.
It's very lovely.
Yeah.
You must have loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was exactly what I needed.
Yeah.
I needed elegance, and I needed training.
Training, exactly.
Tough training.
Exactly.
So it was the perfect spot for me.
Everything has been the perfect spot for you. Every single one of these moves has been the perfect spot. Don't you think?
And we'll get to that, but Sarasota Ballet also just presented itself as the next logical step.
I'm not at all surprised to hear that, but yes, we'll get there.
Yes.
Okay, so the gala happens in May, and I'm assuming it's a success.
Yes, and we're offered contracts to return in July, and suddenly a season is before us.
And suddenly you're a professional dancer.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't a school anymore.
Right.
This is the real thing. You're going to dance, so you're going to get paid, right? It's right.
Right. So,
how old are you now?
I turned 21 just before I moved there.
Amazing.
So it was, I mean, all this happened so fast.
Oh, my God, right. From the class in high school when you must have been 17 to 21. For a guy who was literally not danced until he was 17, and then he's in a company at 21, somebody who started late and got a lot of, I mean, really, this is kind of extraordinary, don't you think?
It is.
Yes. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
It happened to me.
Yes, it did. yes, okay, good. So how long are you with Kansas City, and what happens there? And
I stay there for 7 seasons, and I stay there often for the summer program. I continue training, and the Alvin Ailey Company adopts Kansas City as a second home, and we're performing with that company and doing lecture demonstrations with Alvin's group, and Todd's bringing in repetitors, staging works for us, and Todd's creating quite a bit on
us. Wait a second. 7 seasons, is that 7 years?
Mm-hmm.
So now he's 74, 75?
Yes. Right. Oh, and he keeps going to 93.
Wow. Oh, this is great. Okay, good. Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to stop you.
No, it's all. Una Kai was brought in as the ballet mistress. She had been Balanchine's ballet mistress. So she was staging all of the Balanchine work. Todd was creating his, and then he would supplement with Alvin's work and various choreographers and friends.
So you're working with the top line, everybody here.
Right. And he gets Diana Adams to come and direct the school. She was, you know, one of Balanchine's top ballerinas. And we just really hit it off, and she was really just so encouraging for me, and I was just like wanting to please her. So I had 3 wonderful teachers, all with that same Balanchine focus, and that consistency, I think, was really helpful for me. But at the same time, my late starting body was a little not really loving that little open hip approach. Mm-hmm. It wasn't particularly practical for a late starting body, the intense speed and the forced rotation.
Okay, stop, because I don't know anything about this. And so what I'm imagining is that if you start later, your body has become more rigid and so doesn't allow for those moves which it might have allowed for before you were so formed. Is this correct?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Yes.
And there's nothing to do about that, no matter how hard you work. I mean, I know from yoga that there are some things that no matter how hard I work, my body doesn't want to do them.
Right. And it doesn't, not to say either that everyone who starts dancing early becomes perfectly turned out.
No, it's something about the way
structural.
The body is structured, right?
Right.
Okay.
But
right.
I think I would have been more flexible, and I think my body would have lasted longer had I started sooner.
Uh-huh.
It just would have, I just pushed really intensely with an adult body.
Yeah.
So it was a little hard on it.
Yeah.
So by the time I was, you know, had been there six some years, my body was, you know, in pain, and I'd gotten a fair amount of injuries and you know, just wasn't feeling right. That if I was going to continue dancing, I felt I needed a different focus of movement or different direction.
Yeah.
It just wasn't suiting my body. And who knew what to do at that point? Oh, and in the summers I was doing jazz concerts with friends in Santa Fe. That got me a connection with the Santa Fe Opera, so I was performing there in the summer. So, you know, I did get those exposures to other types of dance that felt better to me.
Well, and the other thing I want to say, which is for me self-evident, is that you're making a living as a dancer. A guy who didn't take a lesson until he was 17, you're doing something which is not that easy to do.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the fact that I stumbled into this sort of starter company was, you know, it was just perfect, because I don't think I would have necessarily been scooped up by a normal company who just needed a dancer to plug into that spot over there.
Yeah, no, it was...
I really needed a nurturing environment.
Yeah, and it was perfect.
Right.
Oh, my God. Okay, so Seven Seasons and...
And then I wasn't sure which direction. I went to New York, and I was looking at various options there. I'd done some guesting up in the Berkshires. I was a Romeo there. I found the company in New Jersey I danced with a little bit. Commuting was difficult. I don't know. I looked into modeling. I auditioned for the Met Opera, but I was too tall for that production. I don't know. Nothing was really... The flow had stopped.
Yes, I hear it, yeah.
It's like, I wonder what I'm supposed to do.
Right
here.
Now, right. Wait a minute, where's the
flow?
Direction, right?
Yeah. So the river turned,
right.
But I couldn't see it.
Yeah.
And at that point, there were family things going on that I didn't have, there was illness and divorce and a lot of family angst that I didn't have any kind of support there. So I thought, at this point in my life, I don't want to go back to school. I'd rather sort of apprentice and just sort of segue and just get wrapped under someone's wing and taken in some other direction.
Right.
And so I started... I got on a computer, which was just beginning there. This was, you know, late 80s, 88 or so. And suddenly I convinced people at public television in New York that I was the perfect person to help them. And I was hired by the press office for public television. It wasn't the station, it was the national press office.
To help them what?
Well, just organize and... And,
oh.
I mean, I was going to obviously be, you know, a ground level person.
Right.
But
you got a straight job.
I did. And suddenly I was walking down Fifth Avenue to work with a briefcase and a trench coat and going to my Fifth Avenue office. It was like, wow, how'd that happen?
Yeah, who's this?
And so I was really a junior publicist is
right.
what I was. So I was talking to press folks, and I was assembling special events as new programs were launched and such. And,
yeah.
and the home office of public television was down in Alexandria, Virginia. So we were sort of the New York base
mm-hmm.
where people would gather for conferences and meetings and such. So I was just sort of this organizer.
Yeah, that's a great job.
Right. And it turned out to be the perfect segue for me to become a ballet master.
Yeah. Surprise, surprise.
So that job wrapped with my dance training became the ballet master position.
Although you didn't know that's what you were doing.
No.
No.
Not a clue.
Not a clue.
So then a relationship came along, and suddenly I had moved to Washington, D.C. I was offered a position with a New York company, a publicity job, and I really could have continued in that line of work with special events and publicity. So
mm-hmm.
I was really proud of myself that I successfully made that transition.
Yeah.
But I made the choice to go to Washington, D.C. with this relationship, and I felt that something would present itself.
I can't imagine why
right.
you would think that.
Right. So I went to Washington Ballet, and they were interested in me dancing there. Mary Day was still alive. But they were touring, and I don't know. I decided not to do that. And suddenly I continued with the event planning, and there was a lot of that, obviously, in Washington, D.C. I was living on Capitol Hill. And I found myself with a company that the owner had worked in the White House during the Jimmy Carter years as the florist and sort of event specialist there. So suddenly I was driving van loads of flowers to the Smithsonian and the State Department and building parties on site.
Oh, my God.
So that seemed kind of cool.
Yeah.
But then it wasn't, and it seemed it was a stressful situation that wasn't a very positive environment. So I said,
Yes, there's always, you're under the gun every minute, right?
Right.
And don't make a mistake, and don't be late, and don't bring the wrong thing, and...
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And that rose is too pink, and I needed peach, and,
God, even worse.
Just great.
Right. Yeah, right.
Yeah, so it's like, this is not feeling quite right either.
Right, right.
So I actually, I was really a new bend in the road without direction. And suddenly I was temping in an office, and I got a position at a law firm as a temporary secretary for someone who had surgery or something. And they offered me a full-time job.
No matter what you do, right? No matter what you do, they say, we want you. Come. Right?
Come.
Right.
And at that point...
So how's that for a cliffhanger? It is at this point in James's extraordinarily circuitous life that his life takes on the trajectory that will bring him finally to Sarasota and the Sarasota Ballet Company, where he is now, and we are so grateful to have him. So if you want to hear how that goes, and it's as interesting as the story up until now, then please tune in next week and listen to the rest of James's story, and also hear what you can expect next from the Sarasota Ballet. Now, you know that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And when you listen to James, you hear an extraordinary journey This is a man who simply said yes to everything that came into his path. It wasn't as though he had a plan or a destination. He didn't. He followed. He understood when the thing that would fit him came into his path that he could simply get on it and ride it. And he did. He rode it with passion, with diligence, with incredible hard work. And that passion and that diligence and that capacity to work hard, which he talks about at the very beginning, but that little 4 or 5 year old boy who was holding on to the chair and doing his exercises with Jack LaLanne, even then he had that determination. And I say right here at the end of this part of the interview, you know, that everywhere he went, everybody wanted to keep him. Well, why wouldn't you want to keep someone who was diligent and hardworking, and in addition to that, clever, talented, intelligent, and incredibly skilled? So we have this remarkable man following the path that the universe seems to be setting down for him and saying, yeah, baby, at every turn. And the rest of the story is as interesting and as compelling. So I'm sure that you will want to hear the rest of it. Well, I am hoping that, as always, this show gave you something that you can use. I'm hoping, as always, that it inspired you to ask yourself, have there been things that came up in your life that you wanted to say, yeah, baby, do, but you weren't able to? Do you remember that feeling of the yearning to do this thing, to embrace it, to make it yours? And it's not too late. Well, it's probably too late to be a ballet master, but not to dance. There may be so many things that you could be doing now that you would have done if you could have done them. So, this is the theme of The Lynn Show. Ask yourself, have you sacrificed something important about you? And do you want to try and get it back? So, as always, I hope that you got something from this show that you can use. Something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, as will James Jordan. And I sure hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night.